So today, it's my pleasure to talk a little bit about the effects of converting conventional cropping systems to bioenergy cropping systems. We've talked about this quite a bit already over the past 7 years or so, since the Energy Independence and Security Act mandated increased production of biofuels. We've made quite a bit of progress, as was shown in some of the earlier talks, increasing biofuel production from about 5 billion gallons to currently around 14 billion gallons. Still, most of that has come from corn ethanol, focused in the Midwest, and even the cellulosic facilities coming online are in this region as well. And in order to kind of increase even further, I think the efforts of looking at cellulosic ethanol in other regions of the country, and so some of the work that we've been doing have been evaluating some of those potential crops for the Southeast. And so in this presentation today, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we've learned over the past 7 years, as well as highlight one of our current projects focused on the effects of converting current cropping systems to bioenergy cropping systems and how that impacts ecosystem services. So about 7 years ago, we began evaluating both perennial and annual species for their potential use as bioenergy crops in this region, particularly in Florida. And some of the crops that we looked at for perennial species included sugarcane, energy cane, elephant grass, giant reed, and Miscanthus giganteus, all shown in the pictures to the right. And basically over several locations in several years, we saw pretty similar yields out of the first three grasses there, the energy canes, the sugar canes, and the elephant grasses. And we were able to pretty consistently achieve about 35 dry megagrams per hectare across the different locations in different years. And with giant reed, we tended to see a little bit lower yield compared to those top three species there, although this did depend on location. In regions that, particularly like the location we had in South Florida on the muck soils with lots of water availability, giant reed tended to do a little better there. And we also did a couple studies where we were harvesting more than once a year, and giant reed tended to do better in those type of studies too. And the giant miscanthus that we used in this environment and some of the others that we've used since just tended to not do as well, mostly because they tend to flower relatively early in this environment. And so you could even see that in the prior picture here. This is already flowering in July and August in our environment and tends not to accumulate much more dry matter after that. We also had studies where we've looked at the composition of these different species, and much like Gopal reported in the prior talk, on a fiber basis, they tend not to differ a whole lot in terms of the pentose and hexose sugars that come from the fiber. A little bit of what we saw is the elephant grass may have a slightly higher glucose to xylose ratio than some of the other species. The biggest difference that we tended to see was in the soluble extractives component of the biomass. Not surprisingly, obviously sugar cane is pretty high in extractable carbohydrates, but generally what we saw is that energy cane as well. This is one particular cultivar here, and there's some variability in that, but in general, several of the others we've looked at tended to have higher soluble sugars in the biomass as well, and compared to the elephant grass and miscanthus and giant reed. Lignin concentrations were also pretty similar. In general, we were able to get about 25 megagrams per hectare of carbohydrates out of the better performing species. The nutrient removals were pretty high in terms of potassium for some of these species. This is at the harvest. And so some of these species were removing potassium at 200 to 300 kilograms per hectare, pretty high rates. And then the nitrogen removal rates as well were pretty high in most cases, reaching as high as 200 kilograms per hectare. In terms of some of the annual species that we've been looking at in this region, sorghum's the main one, the one I'll focus on here. We've looked at sweet sorghums, high biomass sorghums, grain sorghums, all over the past 7 years. We've looked at working with energy beets and some of the oilseed crops, particularly in rotation as well. But what I'll present today is mostly what we've done with sweet sorghum. So early on, you know, there was a lot of interest in possibly multiple crops for tuning sweet sorghum, and so we were looking at some of that. For our plant crops, we were achieving pretty good yields, around 61.5 megagrams of stem per hectare, and we were looking at different planting dates in our region. In general, the earlier planting dates tended to do better. Once we started getting into June or later, we started to see yields drop off on the order of 20% or so. And that's across three different cultivars that we have here. When it came to ratooning those, so trying to get a second crop from ratooning that sweet sorghum, didn't have very good luck in any of the environments, even for some of our earlier planted stuff. So March tended to do, so this was the first planting in March, and then ratooning again following that first harvest. And generally, even though that planting date did a little bit better, still we didn't see much, a very good yield period from that. We've been looking at composition of sweet sorghums. This tends to be a little bit more variable, like we saw in the early presentation. In terms of the fiber, lignin concentrations in green here, a little bit lower than what we saw with some of the perennial grasses. Again, the soluble carbohydrates with the sweet sorghum are relatively high. But the one component you have then on the whole plant basis then is, with some of the sweet sorghums we're working with, about 15 to 20% of the plant biomass is in starch carbohydrates in the grain yield. And so out of a single crop then, we're getting on the order of about 15.5 megagrams of carbohydrate per hectare. The removals, interestingly, the potassium in particular was quite a bit lower compared to some of the perennial species relative to the amount of biomass that was being removed. And the nitrogen removal rates were on par with relative amounts of biomass, about 115 to 130 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare being removed. So we've kind of evaluated a number of grasses and found some that will do pretty well in this region. One of the things we've seen and that we saw with that data is that they'll probably require relatively high inputs to sustain those types of yields. We have both current species that could be used for sugar technologies and sugarcane and sweet sorghum, as well as potentially some of the perennial grasses for lignocellulosic conversion. But one of the things that we still don't understand real well in this region is what will be the impact of growing these systems at a large scale on the other ecosystem services that are associated with cropping systems. And so that's one of the studies that we've initiated recently, about 2 years ago now. And I'll present a part of that. We also have another part of that, which is looking at the annual crops, the sorghum versus a cotton peanut rotation in North Florida. And the perennial one, which I'll focus on today, is looking at what would be the effects of converting a bahia grass pasture system to a perennial elephant grass cropping system. And so bahia grasses are predominant forage grass in this region. And so what in one likely land use that would be converted to bioenergy. And so some of the things we're looking at are the dry biomass production. We're looking at the water cycling, water quantity issues, and also water quality issues, as well as the soil carbon dynamics. So the treatments we have in this study are shown here. So we have a replicated field experiment where we have five different treatments. The control or conventional cropping system is the bahia grass there, which in this case is being produced at 50 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. So we're varying inputs here. We have three cuts per year that we're doing with that. And then we have our elephant grass cropping system, and one of the unique aspects of this component is, based on those high inputs of nutrients that we saw before, we're looking at returning amendments from the energy conversion processes into this mix. And so we actually have lignocellulosic vinasse that we're incorporating back in on an annual basis, as well as biochar that we're incorporating in. And this particular treatment with low input fertility on the elephant grass. And then we have a high input fertility, which is more typical of the types of things that we've been doing over the last several years. So this is a 50 kilogram of nitrogen per hectare in the second growing season, and then this is the high input. You know, start to see a little bit of effect from that already. And so some of the things that we've been measuring, as mentioned, dry matter yield, we're doing on the elephant grass plots, one harvest per year in the fall, which is what I have to look forward to when I head back from the meeting here. So usually we do that in mid-November. We do measuring water based on a water balance. So we'll have some estimates of evapotranspiration, where we measure precipitation and irrigation through a tipping bucket, inputs at the site. We measure drainage through these passive wick drainage lysimeters that are placed in the soil about a meter below each of the plots. And then we're measuring soil storage with to a depth of a meter with TDR at I think five or six different locations. And then we're doing that on a biweekly basis and estimating the water budget during that biweekly interval. And then we're also measuring soil carbon on once annual basis after each growing season. So just to present a little bit of data from the first year of that, we're finishing up our second year this year. From the first growing season, no surprise that we're seeing considerably more dry matter from the elephant grass cropping system. Even better this first year than some of the mean yields that we've seen in the past, on the order of 40 megagrams per hectare. And this first growing season, we actually see no difference even with our low input nitrogen compared to the high input and some of the other amendments. It's not really surprising. We've seen that with the elephant grass in the past. The first season of establishment, it's very good at mining what nutrients are available in the soil, and then we tend to start seeing that decrease over time. So we expect that this will start to decrease over time, but at least during this first growing season, we see no effect of that. In terms of the nutrient removals in the first growing season, similar, no real effects of the elephant grass. All of those are much lower than what we've seen with the bahia grass. So this one is one that's been most interesting. The evapotranspiration data that we calculated with our water budget measured on a biweekly basis. Throughout the growing season, we see the bahia grass in the blue, dark blue figure line here. Throughout much of the early growing season and early summer, that's averaging about 4 to 5 millimeters per day of water use, whereas most all of the elephant grass treatments are closer to 7 millimeters, so quite a bit higher water use early in the growing season, and then later in the season coming together. I haven't quite put all that data together on an annual basis yet, but it's going to be significantly more water use by the bioenergy cropping system compared to bahia grass. And the other piece of this puzzle that we're looking at is that nitrate in the groundwater that's draining below the system. So we're seeing less drainage associated with that, and so far it looks like less nitrate leaching due in part to concentration and mostly due to less volume. The soil carbon data, again, we're just putting this together. I think somebody described it as a flea on an elephant in an earlier session. Our elephant's a little bit smaller in these soils down here than in the environment they were looking at, but it's still a big elephant. So our initial soil profile prior to the study initiation here is about 0.5%, something like that, in the soil carbon. And so the first year already, we've seen some effects with bahia grass. Some of that may be due to the transplanting of the bahia grass, but also the biochar amendment and the actually low input seem to favor at least a trend towards accumulating soil carbon more than the high input treatments. So this, the NAS here is about 3 to 4% nitrogen on a dry matter basis, so it also contributes a lot of nitrogen in the soil. And then the 250 nitrogen, both already even in the first season are trending towards declining soil carbon. So just to briefly summarize all that, we're seeing enhanced productivity with our bioenergy cropping systems. So far, at least during establishment, we're seeing quite a bit of difference in evapotranspiration between the two systems, which we'll see this year. We're starting to put that data together, whether that continues. And then we're looking at this over 4 years for the soil carbon and also collaborating with soil scientists that is looking at some of the fraction, size fraction classes, which may give us a better indication as to the carbon dynamics as well. And so I got a lot of people to thank and acknowledge over that, and I didn't include everybody in there, students and collaborators over the course of all of that study. But one in particular would be the USDA that's helped to support all of these activities. And with that, I'd be glad to take any questions that you may have. I think we have time. Should be good. Yes. We haven't done, we do that when we're doing the coring, just estimates of root biomass at the same time that we're collecting our soil carbon coring. I haven't looked at that data yet, but we'll have some of that. We have looked at elephant grass decomposition rates from root biomass, and they do decompose very quickly, and I think that's one thing that helps facilitate that nutrient mineralization that they have. Their tissues break down very quickly. That's a good question. That is during, the other thing I didn't point out, that's typically our rainy season where we do get, on average we get 53 inches of rain a year, and the majority of it occurs during that time period. But it's also an environment that's dependent on lots of groundwater recharge. It's the springs that are fed in the northern part of the states, and those feed stream flows that feed into shellfish production and other regions in that area. Without running the numbers, it looks like it may be 30% or 40% greater water extraction, something like that, would certainly be a concern, I think. The downside is the upside would be that another issue is the nitrate in that groundwater, and it may be a positive benefit from that perspective. So, could be both good and bad.